College of Law. That does it for our show. A very happy birthday to Hani Massoud. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Massoud, Sanji Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely, and Emily Anderson. If you want to sign up for our daily digest news in your email box, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programmings of KBOO in accordance with and requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee will meet twice in September via public video conference. The Finance Committee will meet on Thursday, September 7th at 5:30 p.m. and again Thursday, September 21st at 5:30 p.m. A public link and phone number to attend the virtual meeting can be found at our website at KBOO-FM. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a growing wildfire burns near Oregon communities and the source of most of Portland's drinking water. A first in the country for Oregon's nurses, how it could affect your health care, and how Oregon led the way in creating what we now celebrate as Labor Day.
Oregon, Washington State, and this is where some of the most innovative, progressive legislation to help labor originated in the U.S.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 31st, 2023. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us. Oregon's first in the nation nurse-patient ratios are about to start. For example, under a new law passed this year, there can be only one nurse per patient in operating rooms and during labor and delivery, and nurses are ensured to only have a certain number of patients at any given time. Eric Tegedoff talked to the leaders of the Oregon Nurses Association about what these changes mean.
A law to decrease Oregon nurses' workload goes into effect on Friday. Passed by state lawmakers this session, the law includes the first nurse-to-patient staffing ratios in the country. The law will be phased in, with rulemaking beginning tomorrow. Nurse ratios for the public will begin in June 2024. Matt Calzia with the Oregon Nurses Association says his and other unions partnered with hospitals to get this law passed.
The collaborative process that we got here, it demonstrated that Oregon is a leader, and that within the hospital association and some of the hospitals, we have leaders who acknowledge that this is what's needed to start repairing our broken healthcare system. This is one of the components.
Some of the ratios include 4 non-trauma patients per nurse in the emergency department and 2 patients in the intensive care unit per nurse. Calzia says while the ratios aren't much different from the current practice, the new law includes a way to ensure enforcement. He notes that another improvement is to the break system. Currently, when a nurse takes a break, they hand over their assignments to another nurse.
So we got rid of that, and hospitals won't be able to do that kind of doubling up of assignments anymore.
Unfortunately, Calzia says some hospitals that have historically had more staff per patient than what is required by this new law could increase the number of patients for some nurses.
That does not seem consistent with what the intent was of the law, which is to improve working conditions and the experience of patients and to enable nurses and other healthcare workers to provide really high quality care to patients who are in the hospitals.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The Camp Creek fire burns on close to 2,000 acres now, primarily in Clackamas County, but it's starting to encroach into Multnomah, and it's less than 2 miles from the watershed and water treatment plant that serves much of the Portland area. This week, the firefighting teams held several community meetings answering questions for people who live within miles of the flames. Here's part of what they said in the Corbett community, starting with a question posed to Incident Commander Evans Kuo.
So you stated earlier that this fire is now currently 0% contained. Do you have a timeline or a possible prediction where you could start containment and maybe complete containment?
I imagine in the coming days, we'll start to slowly have incremental increases in containment, but it'll be pretty low percentages for right now. Probably won't be until at least a couple more weeks before we really start to see significant gains. I'll be honest, firefighters were, by nature, were kind of pessimistic. So even though we may have stopped a certain portion of the perimeter, we're kind of reluctant to call it contained until we're pretty certain it won't. So please be patient with us. Just because we're showing either zero or low doesn't mean we're not doing anything, doesn't mean we're not having any success.
You only have 250 personnel currently as resources for the fire. What are the percentages that are on that side versus Road 14? And what would increase the priority of Road 14 besides just breaching that lower boundary?
We're an equal opportunity. We're trying to grab all the flanks because if we can do that, I mean, our primary goal is to keep the fire as small as possible, and up for a number of reasons. One is, yes, you're correct. It does protect the watershed and the watershed values, but it also keeps the fire from going towards residences to the south. So we're like an equal opportunity. We put the firefighters where we have the best likelihood of success. And, you know, I mean, if you want numbers, I'd say it's pretty evenly split between north and south. We have orders out. But so what's going on right now in the country is we're at the peak of Western fire season. And we've got, I think, 10 or 12 large fires in the going on in Oregon, Washington that are, you know, that require an incident management team like mine on them. In addition to that, in the last 48 hours between Oregon, Washington, mostly on the west side, I think they took about 120 new fire starts. And every one of those, well, and those fires are everything as the size of that table to 20 acres to 100 acres. And every single one of those fires, it requires resources. So we've got about 20,000 firefighters deployed nationwide right now, which is, it's getting up there. We still have some more to give. And every day I see the numbers go up as we activate more firefighters from different parts of the country that are not under extreme fire.
So has anybody approached the governor to declare a conflagration act to draw in more resources?
Yep. The Conflagration Act has been discussed, and we're looking at, you know, what would be the trigger points for doing that. And right now, I think if, you know, we're having conversations about that. Yes.
All right. With respect to, you know, procuring resources and whatnot, where do you stand? Where does this fire stand with respect to the equipment that it needs, the people that it needs, the aircraft that it needs, the access that it needs?
Well, like any other firefighter worth their salt, we're happy with what we got, but we could probably use more. We do have a mechanism to order resources. And yeah, so we've got outstanding orders. They're getting filled, but we've also got some other mechanisms to work within the state to, in the event that the orders that we placed aren't filled, then we can go to that secondary mechanism. So we're working on it. We have national systems that, you know, that are the different areas can hire people in those areas, and we have to meet those obligations first. Once we exhaust those obligations, then we can start looking at emergency hire of additional people that didn't sign up ahead of time.
Yeah, I just have a quick question. Everybody talks about the cell phone and the internet. There's many people up here that do not have proper service. And it's, I mean, they've been promising for 25 years, but we're still waiting. So what do they do, any landline? I am one that kept my landline because of it.
I can talk about some of the notification possibilities and options we have. If landlines don't exist, you don't have cell phone, don't have broadband, you're definitely limited when it comes to communications. When you sign up for public alerts, you can sign up to have other people tied to your address that have a cell phone. So what options you do have, you can help have someone from out of the way that has a means to reach you to come notify you, however they would normally notify you. I realize you're limited in terms of what that communication is, but that's one of the things that we strongly encourage, is have somebody outside the area that can get communications do that. If you know neighbors that have better communications, amateur radio, friends that have amateur radio, they can put channels around, handheld radios to do that. These are all for level 1 and 2 evacuations. I'll let Captain O'Neill talk about what happens once we reach that level 3, you have to go notification.
Good evening. I'm Captain Brad O'Neill with the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office. I work hand in hand with Daniel. We've been on this since Saturday morning early, I think. Friday, yeah. I don't even know what day it is. But yeah, so once we do reach a level 3, what we end up doing is sending Sheriff's Office personnel door to door in those level three areas to try and do our best to notify everybody just as another safety check to let you know that you are in a level three. We are telling you it's time to go. And so it'll be up to you to make that decision that it's time to go.
That's part of a community meeting about the Camp Creek fire burning in the Bull Run watershed, the source of Portland's drinking water. Climate change groups are pushing to pass offshore wind bills that could impact the West Coast. Suzanne Potter has that story.
In the waning days of the legislative session in Sacramento, climate change groups are promoting two bills that would smooth the way for offshore wind energy. Assembly Bill 3 would require the state to study improvements to port infrastructure to move power into the grid. And AB 80 would research impacts on the ocean ecosystem. Former State Senator Fran Pavley, now with the USC Schwarzenegger Institute, says offshore wind will help California become energy independent.
We can create the jobs here, the supply chain, and actually produce the energy here, especially when it's renewable energy that does not pollute the environment and helps us reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. I think that's a win-win for everyone.
Plans are in motion to put floating platforms the size of the Eiffel Tower in federal waters about 25 miles off the towns of Morro Bay and Humboldt, where winds blow almost around the clock. Alex Cornell Duhu is president of the nonprofit Elected Officials to Protect America. He says offshore wind has the potential to generate 112 gigawatts of power, the equivalent of 112 nuclear power plants.
In a state where we need a 3% increase in power every year for electric cars and other resources, this is vitally important to ensure that California is protected, but is also prosperous.
This month, 50 key leaders in offshore wind gathered in Long Beach to hear about Pier Wind, a massive floating turbine manufacturing plant proposed for the deep water port. Long Beach Mayor Rex Richardson says his city has the workforce and the infrastructure to make it happen.
We need more than 1,300 turbines to be built in order to meet the need. So we're unique because we have space in our pier that will allow us to manufacture these sites right in the open ocean and put them directly on barges and ship them across the West Coast.
A recent poll found that 83% of adults in California are in favor of offshore wind. I'm Suzanne Potter.
The U.S. Public Interest Research Group Education Fund finds that 16% of black adults report a high amount of medical debt, as do 9% of white adults. As Alex Gonzalez reports, understanding medical bills can save you some big money.
Medical care is expensive and continues to get more costly. Many people only become aware of this after they get a bill for their care. According to the Arizona PERG Education Fund, 1 in 10 adults in the U.S. carry medical debt, including nearly 11 million people who owe more than $2,000. Healthcare director for the group, Patricia Kelmar, says whether you have insurance or not, medical bills can quickly become a financial headache. That's why she helped create a medical guide to help navigate medical bills and know your patient rights to avoid unnecessary charges.
Bills come in dribs and drabs, and it's hard to keep track of what you owe and what you don't owe. So particularly in a situation where you might have been hospitalized for a week or a few days, ask for an itemized list of all the services that you got with the prices.
Kelmar says regular people are putting your bill together, and there's a good chance billing mistakes are made. She encourages people not to assume your bill is accurate. She adds hospitals are required to now post the prices of their top 300 most shoppable services, meaning knowing cash or insurer prices can help you negotiate down your bill. Under the No Surprises Act, those who are not insured have the right to ask for what Kelmar calls a good faith estimate for the needed care. She encourages everyone to hold on to that estimate because if your final bill's total is $400 over the initial estimate, you could hold the provider accountable. If you do have health insurance, Kelmar says the most important thing you can do is use an in-network doctor or hospital to keep out-of-pocket costs down. The No Surprises Act protects you from surprise medical bills when you receive emergency care in an out-of-network ER, but not an urgent care center.
One important thing to do in advance for emergency situations is to understand where your in-network urgent care center is. Even when you go on vacation, where can I go where I can be in-network and get the treatment that I need?
Kelmar also warns about credit cards being offered in medical settings. She says they often promise zero interest for a number of months, but will then charge much higher interest than a regular credit card, up to 30%. She says unless you're sure you can pay off the debt in the short time allotted, she doesn't recommend taking the offer. I'm Alex Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather and air quality alerts in effect until noon Friday for Multnomah and Clark counties for smoke associated with a Camp Creek fire near Mount Hood. Showers early, cloudy overnight, a low around 60. Then tomorrow's weather, partly cloudy skies, a high of 83. For today in history, we're taking a look at Oregon's connection to Labor Day. Did you know Oregon originated Labor Day, the first state in the country to make it an official holiday? I talked to history professor Dr. Christopher McKnight Nichols, formerly of Oregon State, now at The Ohio State University, to find out more. The first Monday of September, Labor Day, we know this is a celebration of the American worker, and Oregon happens to be the first in the nation to pass a law recognizing Labor Day on February 21st, 1887. And it's rooted, the whole history of the holiday is really rooted in the Progressive Era. And since you're a scholar of the Progressive Era, I'd like to ask you, first of all, what was going on with the labor movement at that time in our history?
Yeah, so it's Labor Day is a good opportunity to reflect on the longer history of labor movements, better understood probably in the plural in the U.S. The first big origin of the of what we think of as Labor Day in the 1890s comes in 1894 with the so-called Pullman strike that the soon-to-be, but not yet, five-time socialist candidate for president Eugene Debs helped organize. At the time, he was the head of the American Railway Union. And the Pullman strike lasted from May until through June into early July, I believe, in 1894. And it was this really kind of outsized moment, which scholars kind of refer to as prophesying the future. Debs is thrown in jail. He spends 6 months in prison, and Grover Cleveland winds up pushing forward with the idea of a national holiday as partly a response to rising labor activism in the Guild of Asian Progressive Era. So you get things in that era. The American Federation of Labor, AFL, is founded. The CIO is founded. Congress of Industrial Organizations, which we now know of as having merged, the AFL-CIO. They grow something like 50% in urban places. So, you know, in Chicago, by the early 1900s, you have 350,000 members of Chicago unions. The AFL grows from something around 400,000 members in the late 1890s to more than 2 million by 1904. And why is all this happening then? Well, the basic answer is that labor organizations are asking for things like a set wage, more limited hours, you know, 5-day work week, something like a 12-hour day, 10-hour day. Nowadays, you know, people would generally speaking not recognize some of those limits as things that they'd want. In fact, we're actively advocating for a lot more. And then this was the era of unregulated corporate capitalism. So lots of big businesses were really, frankly, exploiting their workers significantly. And as much as we might think that in the 2020s, workers don't get a good shake, they were absolutely terribly off in the late 19th century, early 20th century. And that's why we call it the Progressive Era, that progressives from across political ranks tried to figure out how to make society better for everyone.
I mentioned earlier how the first Labor Day bill in the country was passed in Oregon, and that happened shortly after the Haymarket Affair in Chicago. That happened in May of 1886. How do you think that massacre might have actually been related to why Oregon was first in the nation?
Yeah, so I think a lot of the big fears of violence come out of these strikes and riots. And some of them are called riots, but they're really massacres. And some of the massacres actually were perpetuated by, you know, police or private militia against those who were striking or rioting. And so they're sometimes better understood in those terms. In 1886, the Haymarket riot was one in which a number of Chicago police were killed when pipe bombs, other bombs were thrown around. and a number of other strikes and riots from in New York City, for instance, in 1882, took on tens of thousands of people. And that was actually arguably the first September 1882 Labor Day parade in U.S. history. That was in New York City. And so a lot of these activities that then resulted in violence were what pushed the hands of business leaders, politicians, and others, obviously, to take action. And it's worth noting in Oregon history, Oregon, Washington State, and this is where some of the most innovative progressive legislation to help labor originated in the U.S. And in that era, people thought about, so in the 1880s, 1890s, turn of the 20th century, the states as these so-called laboratories for democracy, where you could tinker with the rules and regulations for, say, how many hours a week people could work. Or another big issue was, you know, could and should pregnant women work the same kinds of hours and the same sorts of jobs as men? And this is how you start to get differential laws related to the capacity of people by gender, which today, of course, there's some problems with that. If you think about how people, we think about having less gendered ways of understanding the law and more thinking about people and personhood, right? But that said, it was really innovative and important to protect pregnant women in the workplace. You can think about industrial accidents and other kinds of problems as just a part of that.
Yeah, sure. And interestingly, at the time it passed in Oregon, the Oregonian took exception to it. And this is what they wrote in an editorial on February 10th of 1887. They called it the silliest method of aiding labor to have a bill to declare a special holiday in June to be known as Labor Day. There is sufficient inclination to idleness. There are sufficient incentives to productivity already, just in the way labor is to be benefited by an invitation to shut up shop or stop the plow upon a particular day in the busy season. Interesting, huh?
You know, that's fascinating. Yeah, that's fascinating. I mean, you know, I think just to zoom out for a second, what's the core idea here? It's a working person's holiday. Mm-hmm. The idea is that you're off. You know, nowadays we think about it as a paid holiday, but then it was just a day you did not have to work. And it's interesting to hear the Oregonian kind of saying that that's like a gift or a sop to the working person. It's not really effective. You could or should do something else. And while you could imagine that a kind of reform-oriented, say, progressive newspaper might make that kind of argument, this one doesn't sound like that, actually, at least not what you read. It's not very sympathetic to, you know, the idea of the workers getting unpaid time off to live their lives.
But now we have like 80 countries celebrating International Workers' Day around the world. So things have changed a lot in that time.
They have indeed. And it's also worth remembering that the workers pushed this up through the ranks of politics in a number of governments, not just here in the U.S., but the story in the U.S. is of as a national holiday, it comes in 1894. So well after the state of Oregon does it with Grover Cleveland. And you see similar moves, sort of unrest and attempts to generate better working conditions for working people in Germany and France and Great Britain that also result in national labor days and other kinds of celebrations. And I should say again, the violence of some of those strikes and other activities, which were often channeled by the people trying to stop the strikes, it very much then perpetuated and pushed forward this kind of innovative thinking about how to re-legislate and think through these things across a number of countries. So it's fascinating how there's now more than 80 countries celebrating Labor Day, and that states like Oregon, we don't tend to reflect on the fact, we're leading the charge, in fact, in making these, marking a particular moment, the first Monday of September, as a day for a working men's rest, as they would have put it in the 1880s and 1890s.
Now, here's another little tidbit that I think is interesting, too. Oregon's 8th governor, Sylvester Penoyer, signed the House Bill 102, which declared Labor Day. So he was in favor of it. He was a Democrat. However, his reasoning was he supported labor unions and favored the use of American labor over that of Chinese immigrants. Mm. So that was his reasoning behind that.
And, you know, I love that you pointed that out. So one of the most important things to understand from a contemporary perspective about labor organizing in the late 19th century in the Gilded Age and Progressive Era was that it often went hand in hand with immigration restriction. So the sort of heroes or the people you would assume of the, say, American left or the American right, if you want to go there, don't quite fit perfectly in this model of labor organizing in that era. The idea then was if you could limit unions to so-called Anglo-Saxon people, especially men, they could get higher wages that could help support their families, and it would push back against immigration and people who were thought of as inferior in society. So the most famous example of this is the labor organizer Samuel Gompers, who was against large-scale immigration into the U.S. Because he wanted to keep much more demand for American workers.
Mm-hmm. I think at the same time that we could say that labor unions pressed and activists sacrificed a lot to gain recognition for the special holiday for both the contributions and the mistreatment of workers.
Absolutely. I think that's exactly right.
That was historian, author, and professor Dr. Christopher McKnight Nichols at The Ohio State University. The number of high school graduates going on to higher education dipped in 2021, according to a new report. Eric Tegadoff finds in Washington State, the pandemic hit students' post-high school goals hard.
Washington State saw a dip in the number of people who gained post-secondary credentials during the pandemic. A new report from the organization Washington Roundtable found that in 2021, the number of high school graduates who received a credential by age 26 was 40%, down from 43% in 2019. Brian Jeffries with Washington Roundtable says there also are some worrying signs going forward when students are asked about college or other post-secondary education training.
Surveys of students since the pandemic indicate that they've lost some of that competence in their own preparation and to some degree some interest.
The latest report shows the first dip in post-secondary attainment going back to 2006. In 2016, Washington Roundtable set a goal of helping 70% of high school students go on to receive credentials by the class of 2030. The report shows that attainment levels are lower for students of color, who may face higher hurdles to receiving credentials. One possible reason for the dip is the tight labor market, which means students can make more money out of high school. Jeffrey says young people might make $20 an hour, which sounds good.
But 3 years from now, 5 years from now, when they may have their own children or they want to get a better apartment or own their own home, they're going to need better pay. And the path to better pay will necessitate a credential.
Jeffrey says young people should know that schools and post-secondary institutions are prepared to support people after the pandemic disruption. He adds that there are strategies for boosting students' opportunities after high school, such as partnerships between school districts and colleges.
High school students who earn some college credit while they're in high school through what's called dual enrollment programs, they're much more likely to go on to some form of education post-high school.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegadoff.
A Tennessee special session on guns ends with little action. Conservatives rally to keep former President Trump on New Hampshire's 2024 ballot. And millions more workers could get overtime pay, with more on the stories impacting our democracy. Here's today's edition of 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
Listen to me. I am a pleading mother. I don't want any one of you to feel what this feels like.
Nashville parent Mary Joyce begged Tennessee state lawmakers to pass legislation to potentially prevent another school shooting like the one in March that left three of her daughter's classmates dead. Instead, a week-long special legislative session on guns and mental health ended with little to show for it. One bill was passed encouraging the safe storage of guns, while another increased funding for school mental health services. Pushing and shoving between lawmakers broke out on the House floor as parents shouted their frustrations from the gallery. A newly filed lawsuit aims to keep former President Donald Trump off the 2024 ballot in New Hampshire due to his involvement with the January 6th insurrection. Meanwhile, conservative talk show host Charlie Kirk says his listeners have inundated the New Hampshire Secretary of State's office with phone calls to ensure Trump is included.
And I'm trying to find the pressure points. We are trying to find the pressure points of where they're going to try to pull a fast one against the United States Constitution.
Both the New Hampshire Secretary of State and Attorney General have said any implication that either office is attempting to remove Trump's name is misinformation, and the state is carefully reviewing the legal issues involved. A federal judge has entered a default judgment against former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani in a defamation lawsuit brought by two Georgia election workers. Wandera Arshe Moss says false accusations that she committed ballot fraud made her question her decision to help with the election.
I could have done anything else, but that's what I decided to do. And now people are lying and spreading rumors and lies and attacking my mom.
Giuliani conceded last month he made false public statements, but argued he was protected by the First Amendment. He has been ordered to pay more than $130,000 in fees. A new rule by the Biden administration could extend overtime pay to more than 3 million additional salaried workers. Acting Labor Secretary Julie Hsu says the proposal stems from discussions with employers, workers, and unions nationwide.
To workers who are organizing for power and respect in the workplace, know that we see you, we stand with you, and we will fight for you.
Overtime pay would be extended to workers with salaries of roughly $55,000 a year, greatly impacting those in retail, food, and hospitality managerial positions. And Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell appeared to briefly freeze up Wednesday at an event in Kentucky. It happened just weeks after he experienced a similar episode during a news conference in Washington. The 81-year-old McConnell was asked by a reporter whether he would run for re-election in 2026, but was unable to answer. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 31st, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Eric Tegedoff, Suzanne Potter, and Alex Gonzalez. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service, Native Voice One, and Dr. Chris Nichols with The Ohio State University. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for tuning in. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In-Depth with the Global Citizen International Digest up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest.